Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. Here are some of the barbs Jabari Asim thinks self-styled liberals should get more comfortable throwing around if they care about advancing the cause of racial equality. Duplicitous, racist, delusional, confederate, intellectually challenged, or how about flaccid? There's more where those came from, etched into Asim's latest book of essays, We Can't Breathe, Black Lives, White Lies, and the Art of Survival. Just so you know, these aren't the kinds of essays that end with a simple argument, you know, this is what we need to overcome racism or this other thing. They're more like explorations, weaving past and present, art and news to paint a multidimensional picture of black life in America. Here's Asim reading from his book on the burden African Americans carry just walking around.
Headlines remind us of all the same and different ways a black body can collide with its inconvenience, breathing, walking, waiting to cross at the light, using a golf club as a cane while crossing a Seattle intersection, heading home while carrying candy and a can of iced tea. Any of these can be seen as unforgivable trespass, alien intrusion on ground that must be defended. The wrongful arrests, the point-blank executions, the gunshots to the back, the militarized police responses, the illuminating silence of white self-styled liberals, and most critical, the paucity of convictions, all point to the same existential question. How can we strut in a strange land?
Jabari Asim reading from his new book of essays, We Can't Breathe. He's the former editor of The Crisis, the journal of the NAACP, and a professor at Emerson College. He joins me now in the studio. Jabari, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Evan. I'm glad to be here.
It's my first time sitting across from you, so I'm excited to have you here. So, one of the really remarkable things about the book, for me anyway, is just the sweep of past and present. And start with the opening essay, which is about lying. Yeah, it's a common topic in the Trump era because of the role lies have played in presidential communication. But your point is deeper. Like, for black Americans, it's always been an era of lies. This is not the era of lies. It's always been an era of lies. So why did you start your book there? What do lies mean?
Well, I was kind of fascinated by just the idea of stories clashing. And in my classes, I use this quote from Muriel Rukeyser, where she says, essentially, the universe is not made of atoms. It's made of stories, right? And so we often look at dissent and difference as a matter of clashing civilizations, clashing values. Well, I'm a storyteller, so I look at them as a clash of stories. And so one of the things I'm looking at is the story of the African-American experience here in the United States and the ways in which it has been distorted and twisted and ways in which we can combat that.
And the lying framework, it's important to you because of partly the way your father thought about lying and the way that resonated with your experience of this twisted nature of
I talk about that in the book. I mean, I do sort of go from the personal to larger stories. But in our household, my father sort of policed our vocabularies. There were certain words. Actually, there was a pretty long list of words that we weren't allowed to say or to say to each other. I'm one of six children. And one thing we couldn't do is call each other liars. My father's reaction to that word was something to watch. It really upset him, the idea that we could accuse each other of something as treacherous as falsehoods.
And now everyone is accusing everyone, every other person of falsehoods all the time. There's a lot also in the story, so between the personal and the national, that is local. I mean, about Boston's legacy of racism. Like, tell us, for instance, about the slave wall you stumbled across in Medford.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for it, when I was just going by in a car and it said slave wall, but
it just said slave wall.
And we know who built the wall. We know his name. His name is Pomp. We know when he built it. So I thought, wouldn't it be just so much more simpler and clearer to say it's Pomp's wall?
How do we know who built the wall and when? How did you uncover this?
There's a very good historical society in Medford, and they have a wonderful website. And they're people who've done this work. So since this work has been done, I'm saying, you know, why not bring it out into the light?
Yeah. And even the names are interesting. That is, you point out in this piece that the name Pomp, it's connected to a whole bunch of sort of exaggerated, highfalutin kind of names.
Well, slaveholders, I don't know if it was, you know, their own limited view of heroism or maybe some warped idea of irony. I don't know. But they often gave the lowliest members of society, the people whom they claimed to own as property, these really lofty names. They named them after generals and philosophers and orators. And it's just...
It's like a sick joke. It's hard to get into the mind of someone
right.
who would do
one,
this.
I'm hesitant to speculate, but one does wonder. Yes.
Yeah. And there's a lot more forgotten racism in Greater Boston. I mean, do you feel it when you're walking around? Everything from, you know, the fights over Yawkey Way and Faneuil Hall.
Yeah, I think, sometimes I find myself, I think it's in Cambridge, and I'm walking down a street called Agassiz. And in a previous book, I wrote about, you know, Agassiz's scientific racism and his white supremacy. And it's just ironic to kind of, I even was visiting in a church here one time, and the pastor began his sermon with a big picture of Agassiz, Louis Agassiz, and used him in his sermon as this wonderful guy. And I thought, you know, it's really interesting how we can approach a narrative from different angles and come away with
Listeners a little more about...
Well, Agassiz, he argued, he came to Harvard to found a scientific school, and he argued that the mind of a white infant 3 months in the womb was superior to the brain of a fully adult African-American. So, you know, he made these kinds of arguments that are, you know, sick.
Yeah. Well, there are also moments in the book where you get to express some real pride in your racial identity. The section on your family, for instance, both the family we grew up and the family you've created. But also the section you read from on strutting, which sounds kind of trivial, but which you paint as quite potent. What does strutting mean to you?
Well, I'm totally fascinated. I mean, one of the things that I look at a lot in my work is how the black body moves through public spaces, right? And so strutting is sort of the black body moving at its best when everything is working. But we are moving in a society that often has no room for us, that doesn't actually want us there. So I look at the idea of the black body moving through certain kinds of spaces, actual, you know, geographical, but also metaphorical.
And everything from moving through it with this kind of pride that comes with strutting to the kind of dangers that come with all walking around.
Walking out of bounds, walking from a convenience store to one's father's home, for example, walking to a playground to play. So many of these things end tragically.
Yeah. The final essay of the book is where you really sort of turn directly to politics. It's interesting that you wait for the final essay to do it. Were you trying to avoid it throughout?
There was some thought in how the essays were arranged, yes.
So it's focused partly around this famous moment when Michelle Obama defended liberal values against conservative attacks, saying, when they go low, we go high. But you're fatigued, I would say, maybe, by this notion of respectability politics and the need to go high. Why? What's wrong with going high?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have to point out that this particular argument against the politics of respectability is one that the Black Lives Movement has really pushed to the forefront. But there used to be this idea that if we claimed as oppressed people, if we claimed the moral high ground, then we could sway the consciences of those who choose to oppress us. And I do argue that that's an outdated method. I think the best way to appeal to people who oppress you is to appeal to their self-interest. I don't think that they are likely to make concessions in terms of fairness or equality or justice because it's the right thing to do. I think you have to point out how it benefits them.
Mm. I think one reason that people stick with this argument is because it's partly the way we remember civil rights. Right?
Sure.
The side of civil rights that gets remembered is the placating side, right?
Right.
The turn the other cheek side.
Right, right.
I mean, is that problematic in itself that that's the side we remember?
Well, I can see that the side of kneeling, praying protesters in their Sunday best being attacked by water hoses did indeed sway the consciences of some Americans. But I would argue that that was a small group of people. And I think it's an outdated notion. And I think that... the rights and privileges of citizenship should go to all African-American citizens, whether they're choir boys or not. The fact that they are Americans on American soil, born and raised, should entitle them to the rights and privileges that everyone else gets.
And bound up with this as a fatigue with respectability politics is some harsh criticism for white liberals, which, again, has an interesting history in Boston. We'll get to that in a second. But, you were motivated to direct some anger in that direction. Share.
It's just the I don't know if you're referring to a specific instance in the
No, it's just a general sense that, like, white liberals aren't don't take the kinds of risks that would make them real allies in the movement for equality. That was the sense I get. I mean, tell me I'm wrong.
No, I think that, I mean, we have hashtag activism now, and we have a lot of well-meaning liberals who will, you know, hashtag Trayvon Martin, but they're not going to call their legislator. They're not going to challenge stand your ground laws. They're not going to risk their physical health by marching. They're not going to do any of the things that those of us who don't have the luxury of hiding behind a hashtag have to do. It's not a matter of choice for us. I mean, I have four sons. It's not a matter of choice for me. But I do think that the silence in particular of white liberals, both in social media and in actual spaces, is troubling and illuminating.
One issue. Well, let's get to the local stuff there. One thing it reminded me of just being in Boston is that we have a history in Boston of like white abolitionism, which was a kind of powerful ally for the black anti-slavery movement in the 19th century. And it made me think, is that a model for a better kind of partnership? Or is it better not to have a partnership if white liberals aren't going to take the kinds of risks necessary?
I think that the energy of white liberals is best directed toward their own communities. So we all have these conversations with white liberals over the water cooler where they talk about Thanksgiving and they talk about their racist relatives and how difficult it was. I'd rather have that energy be directed toward their own racist families, toward members of their own communities, than to my community. I think that would be a really effective form of allyship, if you will.
Hmm. You also are critical of the media and the role the media has played. What are we doing wrong?
Well, long-term member of the media myself, so I'm complicit in this as well. But I think we tiptoe around the idea of racism. We put racists in quotes all the time. We say Walter Scott was allegedly shot in the back by a police officer, even though, you know, we can all see the video and the police officer is shooting him in the back. So I think this sort of tiptoeing around declarative language doesn't benefit progressives, certainly doesn't benefit members of oppressed groups in society.
Do you worry that using more direct language of that sort as media institutions would only increase the lack of trust that large swaths of America seem to have in the media?
Well, I would prioritize knowledge and information over trust. I think it's better to be informed.
All right, you find yourself hopeful, despairing?
I think I'm gonna quote James Baldwin: "Despair is a luxury that only white men can afford."
All right, I guess that puts you on one side. So finally, and I have to admit this is a weird place to end, but the title, you know, we Can't Breathe. Of course, in the most immediate sense, it harkens back to the death of Eric Garner, the hands of police officers in New York in 2014. He said 11 times he couldn't breathe as he was held in a chokehold. But in the book, you remind us that phrase has a longer history.
Yeah, I talk about the novels of an African-American writer named Ronald Fair, and one of his novels was actually called We Can't Breathe, and it turns on a police killing of an unarmed black man. So I say, you know, before it became a rallying cry more recently, it's always been sort of a ringing declaration of intent.
So do you see, and this we'll just have to make this quick, but do you see history as being that linear from slavery to lynching to civil rights to Eric Garner? I mean, does it just...
To me, it's more like concentric circles. You know, there's overlapping where some things are actually repeated, and then there are other things that are brand new.
Mr. Bari Asim, former editor of NAACP's journal The Crisis. He's a professor of creative writing at Emerson College and author of several books, including his latest, We Can't Breathe. He'll be at the Boston Book Festival this Saturday and at the Harvard Bookstore on October 19th. There's more information about those events and the book at our website, radioboston.org. Jabari, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Evan.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Evan Horowitz. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.